Thank you, Maggie. Thank you, John. And Parker, thank you so much for including us in your circle of trust. So thank you for being here.
Oh, delighted to be with two old friends.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, the statement Maggie quoted about aging and community development, that's an interesting, putting those together. Could you start by saying a little more about what that evokes in your mind, the fact that elder aging and community development somehow seem to need each other?
Sure, absolutely. You know, I'm 78, as I believe you are, Peter, and John is a little bit our senior, but not much. I'm very aware of the number of older folk around me, people in my age cohort, who really feel unseen, unheard, ignored, and yet who still have so very much to offer. I personally don't feel that way because I've been fortunate over the years to create a work life that is sort of self-determined, and I can keep writing and speaking as long as I'm able to do so. But these elders who become invisible in the community, they have such great experience to bring to so many things. They've been around the block more than a few times. And when I think about the role of the elders historically in many countries, I'm thinking, for example, of Latin American countries like Chile and Argentina, where it was really the grandmothers who called those totalitarian societies back to some form of accountability and always a work in progress, some form of a little bit more democracy. And of course, in many parts of this country now, not only areas where people have few material resources, but other areas as well, it's the grandparents who are caring for the young children as that middle generation of parents finds themselves working a couple of jobs or otherwise unable to care for their own kids. So I think we have a huge asset here that is yet to be tapped and has a lot to do with how in this American culture of ours, which is both glorious and screwed up at the same time, we somehow have this notion that we have to stay young, which is kind of sort of against the laws of nature. I think whenever you try to swim against Mother Nature, you're in big trouble. So that's at least a starting point for some of those thoughts.
How would you invite, what would the invitation sound like? Suppose we decided that we wanted to engage the less engaged elders. How would you construct, what are the kind of spaces or thinking or invitation you would do to initiate something like that?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is the public schools, where there's so much need for older adults to simply sit with children. Very often these days, teachers have too many kids in their classes in order to pay attention to each of them. So this need for older people to sit with students and do simple things like work on basic math problems or issues with reading, or simply read to younger kids, to provide that kind of grandparently presence that I think is so reassuring to younger children. I also think there's a great need among the rising generation of, let's say, 18 to 30-year-olds for conversations about vocation, about what am I called to in my life. It's a very confusing world that people of that age are moving into. I think it's a good deal more confusing than my world was when I was their age. And here we have elders who've negotiated some of that kind of thing. And with proper, I think, training, I think all of this requires training, of course, and vetting to make sure that people are doing this for the right reasons and have the capacity to do it. But with proper training in how to be a mentor rather than someone who sees his or her role as telling a young person what to do, But how to be someone who evokes the dreams and aspirations and hopes of younger people and help, and knows how to help them sort things out. That's an enormously valuable role in a world like ours. I think all of us, Peter, John, and I, we share an interest in faith communities, both traditionally and non-traditionally defined, people who gather around deep questions of meaning and purpose as informed by various traditions, some of them emerging traditions. And I've often wondered why our faith communities are not doing more to host these kinds of, for example, intergenerational relationships. The churches, as I understand the demographics of church life these days, this tends to be an aging population. There aren't a lot of millennials actively joining the churches. And so why not bring some new life to the church by inviting elders to play these creative roles? And of course, what we all know, and I'm sure the folks who are listening to us at this moment know, is that when you reach out to another person that way with a gift of presence, a gift of self, you get back often more than you give. Mm-hmm. And so for many elders, relationships with school kids around simple things like reading and basic math, or relationships with millennials around things like vocational discernment and decision making, this gives the elders a sense of having a valuable role in the community, which many of them start missing either on retirement or when they become empty nesters, or the loss of a spouse. Something happens in one's older years that deprives one of meaning. And activities of the sort that we're exploring here, which are meaning making activities.
You mentioned training, and you said before we came on that your center is focusing on leadership and activists from 25 to 40. If you were training people later on, what's the key kind of training you would give people as they move into a school or move into younger people or a vocational conversation? Give us two or three elements that you think it's important people are trained or conscious of as they cross generations.
Well, let me focus on that 18 to 30-year-old group. I think the schools, certainly the schools in my area, have some very fine programs for teaching older people to be tutors and simple companions to grade school children in some of these ways. But I'm not so aware of programs that prepare people to sit with someone who's, let's say, 22 or 23, 24, and who's searching for direction in a confusing world. So I think the first thing that I would do is to work very hard on helping people develop a capacity to listen. This is something that we do in our what we call our circles of trust through the Center for Courage and Renewal, which has now been up and running in one form or another for 25 years, and we've got 300 facilitators around the globe, really, most of them here in the U.S. or Canada, but a number in other regions as well. And one of the first things we do in these circles is to try to help each other to understand we're not here to make speeches to each other. We're here to listen deeply to each other, to do something that a wonderful feminist theologian called Nell Morton once named as hearing each other into speech. I really love that phrase, that you know, everyone has something to say behind what they're saying, or they have a question behind their question, and we can serve each other so powerfully well by hearing each other into speech. Now, the way we do that is pretty simple. When our circles gather, we say rule number one is there shall be no fixing, no saving, no advising, and no correcting each other. Let me repeat that list. No fixing, no saving, no advising, and no correcting each other. And usually when we announce that, and we're talking here about 25 people who are going to experience, let's say, 5 or 6 retreats with each other of 3 days each over a year and a half, somebody says, well, what in heaven's name are we going to do for the next year and a half? You've just taken away everything we know how to do and like to do. But, of course, what we've taken away are precisely those behaviors that tend to end conversations quickly and to drive us back into hiding, as it were. So if I sit down with a 22-year-old person and I listen for 5 minutes, or if I've been to a listening workshop in the last 2 months, I listen for 8 minutes, and I start telling them what I think they ought to do with their life, given the very few initial surface clues they've given me, that effectively ends the conversation. But right. if I know how to listen, and then secondly, to ask honest, open questions, which turns out to be a high art, really, because most of us are trained to ask questions that are really little speeches in disguise or little advices in disguise. So when I teach people the protocols for asking honest, open questions, I'll often say, have you thought about seeing a therapist is not an honest, open question. you might as well fess up and say, I think you ought to see a therapist, but that's not your job. That's not what we're there for. You're here, you're present to hear that other person into speech. And if you can ask a question like, the experience you just told me about that's so difficult for you at the moment, have you ever had a similar experience in your life? And if the person says, yes, well, can you tell me a little bit about it? Right. And if they do that, and then to ask, was there anything you learned during that experience that might be helpful to you now? That's an example of hearing a person into deeper and deeper speech, where they start to discover that, as we Quakers like to say, everyone has an inner teacher. Everyone has a kind of inner source of guidance, but it often needs the encouragement and the evocation of another person or group of people in order to be heard and in order to be followed.
Let me one more question, then John, I'll turn it over to you. You've written about and talked about periods in your life, Parker, where it's been a struggle for you.
Yes.
And one of the things I read or heard that so touched me, you said everybody who comes to you in those periods always has something in mind. And the only time anybody did anything that was truly helpful was when they rubbed your feet.
Mm-hmm.
And that was so touching to me. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because I think it's related to what you started with, about what is really healing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciate you picking up that reference, Peter. So I've written about the fact and spoken often about the fact that I've had 3 deep dives into clinical depression in the course of my adult life, the most recent one being when I was 65 years old, so about 13 years ago. And a lot of people, of course, in this society suffer from depression or live with someone who does. So, you know, we're all interested in how do we make meaning out of the tough experiences of our lives. And one of my ways of making meaning is to try to understand those experiences well enough to put them at the service of other people, or at very least to sort of stand in solidarity with fellow sufferers. So one of the most frequent things that happens when you're depressed is that people come by and tell you you shouldn't be depressed, which believe me, really isn't helpful. they'll say things that actually leave you more depressed. They'll say, for example, but Parker, you're such a wonderful guy. Your writing and your speaking have helped so many people, and you've counseled with so many people. And when they say that, it the impact is now I've defrauded another person. If they knew what a horrible person I was, which is how you feel when you're depressed, they'd walk out of the room. They wouldn't ever want to talk with me again. So there's this sense of fraudulence that is very depressing. Or when someone says, you should really get out of your room where you have the shades pulled because you need the safety, and you should get outside and, you know, feel the sun and look at the flowers and hear the birds, because that's all uplifting. You get more depressed because you know intellectually that it's supposed to be uplifting, but you can't feel an atom of that uplift or that encouragement in your body because your emotions are dead. So, as I've written, the one person who just in some ways saved my life during my first depression was a friend, a dear friend, a man I trusted who was a few years older than I. He asked my permission to do this, and every afternoon he came by like clockwork at about 4 o'clock. He would always let me know if the day came when he couldn't make it that day, because he knew that I was kind of counting on it. And he just had me sit in a chair in my living room and took off my shoes and socks and massaged my feet for maybe 30 minutes. Mm. And it was, you know, it does remind folks, it certainly reminded me of the foot washing scenes in scripture and in Christian tradition and in other traditions too. But it provided me with it. He somehow amazingly found the only place in my body where I could feel connected to another human being. And he hardly ever spoke. He was a very intuitive person. Occasionally he would say something like, I feel your struggle today, no more than that. On other days he might say, I feel you getting a little stronger. He wouldn't invite a conversation. He would just make these simple observations occasionally. Uh-huh. And what he gave me was one of the most precious gifts you can give a person who's depressed. And it's actually a twofold gift. One is a sense of connection with another human being, which you're utterly lacking in clinical depression. And that's terrifying in and of itself. And the second gift that's implicit in that is you've finally found someone who's not scared of your depression. Mm-hmm. You know, the people who came by who came around with what I call drive-by advice, you know, lob it and leave, were really people who I could tell intuitively were looking at my depression as a contagious disease. Mm. And if they stayed too long, they might catch it themselves. It was depressing to them to see me depressed, and so they were afraid of me. And you're super sensitive to that when you're depressed, and when they drop their advice on you and then run, you really are left in deeper darkness than you had before. But this man stayed with me. He was faithful to me for months, and as I say, I really credit him with helping me see it through.
Yeah, I think thank you so much, Parker. It's true not just for a clinical depression, but it's true for the tragic nature of life and those hills and valleys that we all, that just being human.
Absolutely.
You know, so
when I read your title of the latest book, The Abundant Community, I instantly think of this abundance that we all have if we're not afraid of each other, which is the abundance of simple presence to another human being.
John, is there something you'd like to address?
Well, I was taken by the title here, Aging as an Asset, and I was thinking about at 85 whether or not the people in my age range had something that was an asset. One thing that occurs to me is that through generations, the world outside tends to change. And so if you are a person who has experience and some knowledge or even something called wisdom that you gained, let's say, from 1930 to the year 2000, and then you looked at the year 2017, you might say, in some measure, that what you know may not be awfully useful for the changed world that you see. And in that sense, let me suggest that at the current time, older people in general have had an experience that I think is an asset, but I'd like both your thoughts on how it might be made utilitarian. And that is, I think that people who lived through, I would say, the last half of the last century tend to have had more sense of mutuality and collective life than the people who are here currently. A lot of reasons to explain that and a lot of research that identifies it. But if you went to 1950 on a block in a city, you were likely to find some pretty useful and supportive connections that were there among the people there. I say that having organized on those blocks back then. Today, mostly you would go to a block and people would say, well, I don't really know my neighbors. I know two people next door. Also, in terms of collective experience, we didn't have the kind of separation of income because there was a collective sense in the workplace that we called unions.
Mm-hmm.
So where we lived and where we worked, we had a set of mutual support relationships that I think have pretty well diminished.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is that experience an asset today? And if it is, how might it be manifested?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a fascinating question, John, and I'm delighted for a chance to wrestle with it with both you and Peter. This is where the intergenerational dialogue comes back to me big time.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, the dialogue that is evoked by the question you just asked is one in which I think I can give a concrete example in just a moment, but I speak with young activists about how it was when I was in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And along some of the lines that you just named, and they say to me, yes, but today the conditions are very, very different, and I think they're right in that. Mm-hmm. That is, for example, growing up in the 50s in Wilmette, Illinois, not far from where you live in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I never met an African American. I didn't even meet Jews who lived in Glencoe. They were segregated out from places like Wilmette. Although, accidentally, by happy accident, my best friend in high school was Jewish, and so I spent a lot of time in Glencoe. But there was this homogeneity of the community in which I grew up, which made that some of that mutuality a little easier, although there was the intervening factor of affluence, which cons people into believing that they're independent, not interdependent.
Mm-hmm.
And labor unions have managed over the years, you know, not only to be squashed by the powers that be,
mm-hmm.
but in some cases to have discredited themselves from within.
Right.
So that even the workers got sick and tired of the bosses, you know, having joined the bourgeoisie. So the conversation that I have in mind, and again, I'll give a specific example in a moment, is one about, okay, we want some of that, we want to get that kind of communalism back. We want to get that interdependence back,
mm-hmm.
but the conditions are different.
Right.
So how do I hold my vision of possibility, which I've seen with my own eyes, together with the young person's struggle with a very different set of conditions, and how do we work together on the kind of social processes that might create the interdependent community that's possible today, rather than simply me sitting back as an old man and romanticizing the community of yore.
Right.
Here's the example I have in mind that I've actually been working on in our work with young leaders and activists through the Center for Courage and Renewal. I spent most of the 1960s in Berkeley doing a PhD and, of course, being introduced to social movements and some great transformative events of human history, in U.S. history. And in fact, it was the events of the 60s that sort of kicked me out of academia as a vocation. I mean, I finished my PhD, but by the end of the 60s, my heroes had been assassinated, the cities were burning, there was a horrific war raging, and that's when I became a community organizer for the next 5 years in Washington, D.C., feeling that I wanted to use my sociology on the streets, that it would be put to better use there than in academia. So today, I've always been interested in social movements, and today I tune in, as I did several years ago, to the Black Lives Matter movement,
mm-hmm.
which I'm an absolute devotee, and I see this T-shirt that some activists are wearing that says, "This ain't your mama's civil rights movement." and I realize, oh, I've got some learning to do around how movements today are taking a different form than they did in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
One of my most powerful experiences in recent years was in 2011, going on the annual civil rights pilgrimage led by Representative John Lewis, which was this three-day jaunt through, or trek through, Birmingham, Montgomery, and then to Selma, where on the 46th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, John Lewis led a bunch of us across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, just as he had originally at age 24. And it was very moving. I learned a lot from that. I was reminded of a lot that was important then and is still important today. But I was also reminded of the fact that at that time, television was relatively new, and we were not nearly as inured to violence on TV as we are today. And so America was watching, and America was scandalized by the brutality of Bloody Sunday. And within a few months of that march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, Congress had passed the 1965 Civil Rights Act. I don't think that would happen today just by putting it on TV. I mean, everything's on TV, and not much happens out of it, right? Because it's...
What do you feel is today's movement, and connect that with what's happening nationally and how you think about the national scene too?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a work in progress for me, and it's one of the reasons I'm having these dialogues with young leaders and activists who, for example, aren't all as concerned as I am about the collapse of some of the traditional forms of organized religion, because they're inventing new forms of organized religion, and they don't have the sense of grief that my generation does about how some of the institutions we once relied on are no longer functioning very well because they're inventing new institutions. And, you know, part of what's fueling their different way of thinking about all this is social media. We were joking with each other early that for guys who are in the last quarter of life, we don't do too badly at social media, but we don't do nearly as well. I think we're not as agile and not as effective as some of the millennials are, as they set about to organize for the things they care about in ways that that make a difference, but that people of my generation don't know much about. So I think, you know, I'll say this. As I talk to them not only about the Black Lives Matter movement, but about the larger social movement that when Obama was still in office got this country to say okay to same-sex marriage, sort of, you know, across the board, mm-hmm. I started realizing it had been a long time since I saw LGBTQ folks sort of on the street dominating the TV news with that form of social movement. And I started learning that a lot of their actions had been state by state in the courts and within, you know, corporations to kind of make incremental gains, which finally reached a tipping point and resulted in a kind of across-the-board possibility for same-sex marriages in places that you would never have thought it would happen. And so when the current administration came to power, my first thought that very night, the night of November 8th, was not about the Democratic Party. It was about the ACLU. I thought, okay, this is a point at which one would hope that the legal institutions that are so critical to a democracy would hold, and it just as they had advanced the LGBTQ movement over the preceding couple of decades, which operated kind of behind the scenes. Well, it wasn't long before the ACLU, it was two ACLU lawyers who got a restraining order slapped on the first Muslim ban, and yes. I mean, let's call it what it is, on immigration. And they've been very effective, I think, ever since in holding back the tide. So, you know, I don't think anybody has figured this thing out yet. What is the new form of a social movement? But I don't think it's the street actions that I cut my eye teeth on, and that helped advance things in Berkeley and in Selma and against the war in Vietnam. I don't think that's the way to go anymore. I mean, it is impressive when hundreds of thousands, millions of women, for example, show up on the streets around the globe. But if you start connecting the dots and asking, okay, what does that do beyond saying to us that a lot of people care about this, and that has value in itself, I don't think it does as much as what happened when the American public in 1965 saw nonviolent young people being bloodied and beaten by officers of the state. So I'm holding a lot of questions about this. Those are some of them.
Thank you. Let me stop a second. See if people want to. Thank you so much, Parker. Why don't you put out a call for people calling in, Maggie?
Sure, and we do have one caller already, but I'd like to invite you all to join the conversation. If you dialed in, you can press *8 on your telephone and you'll be put into a queue. We also have some questions in the chat, Peter. I don't know if you can see those, but at the moment, I'm going to go ahead and invite a caller from East Iowa. Hello, are you there? Caller from Iowa? Okay, I guess we might have lost that caller.
There's a question on the chat, and you say it's not Paramama's civil rights movement. The question is, does this deny history and disrespect it? You know, the struggle when we talk about, you know, the 50s or 60s is that it can be felt as a kind of nostalgia. So, whereas I think what you're saying, Parker, there's a moving forwardness that's not clear to us now. And any thoughts you have about history and memory and what's new and fresh and just in whatever that triggers in you, Parker?
Yeah, you know, I don't believe in history denial even any more than I believe in science denial. You know, I try very hard not to deny reality, actually, as often as possible. I remember there was a great exchange between a transcendentalist named Margaret Fuller back in the 19th century and Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Margaret Fuller said, "I accept the universe," and Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "By God, she'd better." and I that made an impression on me, you know. So I don't think it's historical denial, but I think it's an acknowledgement that you never step into the same stream twice, and that the factors that go into any historical mix are a very complex and constantly changing body of variables, and you have to adjust accordingly as those variables ring their changes. So I think there's a lot to learn from the 60s. One thing, and some of it is negative lessons. This is another thing I deal with some of my younger colleagues, is that, you know, back in the 60s, there were a lot of people, at least in Berkeley, that I knew who were convinced that we were going to change the world by the end of the decade. And when we didn't, they threw in the towel and went to work for Goldman Sachs. some of us didn't. But today's young activists are, I think, better represented by a book written by a friend of mine, a woman, 35 or so, named Courtney Martin, who wrote a very fine book called Do It Anyway, about the younger generation of activists. And her basic thesis is they understand they're not going to change the world overnight or even real soon, but they do believe in incremental change, and they believe in the absolute importance of witnessing to their own values in an active way. So they do it anyway. Well, that's a generational shift from where we were in the 60s, full of a kind of, I think, false optimism about how efficacious we were going to be, and then giving up when we weren't. That's the danger of false optimism, is you throw in the towel and it doesn't work out.
It's also the danger of having to see results.
Yeah.
You know, as a driver of your energy, and I've always felt lucky that I've never been burdened by the need to see outcomes from my efforts.
That is good luck, man. No, I absolutely agree.
Yeah. Parker, something that may be abiding across our life experience with movements is that it seems to me they have two kinds of outcomes, at least. One is legislative change. whether it's the civil rights or the women's or the environmental or the LGBT revolutions and movements, right? All of those get manifested in enough popular change that it shows up legislatively. But the other thing, and we're more conscious of it, I think, in the movements of the 60s, is they also change culture underneath. And so I think that maybe we're in a time when the culture is changing underneath, but the manifestations of a movement are not yet very visible. And then something will emerge in the legislative or rulemaking world.
Yeah, I think that's possible. It may even be that we're in a process of reconstituting the institutions of democracy, potentially in a good way, to make them more robust as we become more aware of the fragility of the system we have. So I think that one of the good things that's going on right now, and I'm certainly not the first person to point to this, a lot of people have, is that, you know, what's been happening with the new administration is that a lot of us have been forced to take off our blinders or our rose-colored glasses about the fundamental nature of this society. We've been forced to think back on our founders, who were geniuses when it came to the creation of an absolutely remarkable system of government, which, as I like to say, is the first system I know anything about that treats conflict not as the enemy of a good social order, but as the engine of a better social order.
Yeah.
So we need to learn to value conflict. But they were also bigots. And they had blinders on when it came to Native Americans. I mean, they sponsored genocide, and to women, and to enslaved human beings, and to people who didn't own property. We, the people, had a very, very narrow meaning in the minds of the founders. But the genius is that they gave us this system, which has allowed us over the years to correct their errors, you know, to basically say to our founders, you got it wrong. We the people is a much larger collection of folks than you ever imagined or maybe would have approved of. So with the blinders off, with the rose-colored glasses off, you know, we about American culture, the very thing you're talking about, John, we have a chance to work away at cultural change at sort of the DNA level, the genetic level.
Yes. Yeah.
If you think of DNA, put quotes around DNA, national DNA, our cultural DNA, which has been holding us back and dragging us down for a very long time. And it's really hard to deny any longer that we have these same strains of pathology in the body politic that the founders planted there.
Let me, if I could, Maggie, do we still have a couple of callers on?
Yes, we do.
How about inviting them to hear their voices?
All right. Okay, so we have a caller from California.
Yeah, this crazy old Richard Lewis, 80 years young.
Welcome,
and I missed you. My question to the three of you, because I'll follow up. I'm at the table of 113 of the community colleges of the 1,000 in the country, and it's really hard to get other people to see what I think all three of you hold, that we need to listen to their future. And while I talk a lot, I've got 3,400 almost on my LinkedIn, I really would love to see what it might look like to bring that voice to this particular structure, guys. It's a 503C, just with a letter of understanding to the trustees. And certainly, you know, I try to let people know that generation to generation is there. You can have a master's degree and go to a California community college and be involved in student government. So I'm going to stop and follow up, being on the call, what your own insights are as to starting that cornerstone, not limiting it to that particular student structure out here in California. We are pretty progressive. Remember, John, Santa Cruz.
Yeah, I was in Santa Cruz when Paige Smith was there, so I do remember, and I'm sure we all do. Well, without knowing, a lot more detail about your particular situation, I don't know that I can speak directly to it. But let me say this. I recently had an experience with an organization called Ashoka, which some of you may be aware of. It's a very interesting international organization sponsoring young social entrepreneurs who are doing a remarkable range of good things in the world. And they have a set of that organization that's called Ashoka U, Ashoka University, as it were. And they have, you can find them online, they have put together an assembly of what they call changemaker campuses, which are across the country and around the world. They started a couple of years ago, and I think they're up to 50 or 60 now. Changemaker campuses, which have basically taken a pledge to get students engaged in thinking and speaking and listening and being listened to the way we're talking about here, around serious issues of social transformation. I spoke to about 800 of them down in Miami and was enormously impressed with a spirit there that, again, I identify as very much of the 21st century, not the same kind of spirit that animated the 60s in Berkeley. It seemed to me more knowing. It seemed to me wiser. It seemed to me more grounded and less prone to flights of fancy, and therefore more promising about getting some traction in the real world. So for whatever it's worth, I would point folks who are interested in higher education to Ashoka U and their Changemaker Campus program.
We have that link on the website, on the chat room, just in case people are interested. So thank you for that.
Great.
I also think that Ashoka and the movement now is also an entrepreneurial dimension to it. It's treating the marketplace as the platform or venue for transformation.
Absolutely.
Arguing against commerce, but producing commerce. Is there another caller on the line, Maggie? I want to get to that because
we do. We have two callers on the line. We also have a question that was posted early on and then repeated that I think I'd like to address also, which is...
Let's get the callers, though.
Do the callers, okay.
Yeah.
So, all right, so I'm inviting our second California.
Yeah, am I talking?
Hello, Peter.
Yes.
Yeah, am I online here?
Yes.
Okay, first of all, I am absolutely enchanted by this conversation. I think the premise to hear people into speech is one of the most beautiful statements I've heard in a long time, and I want to just sort of savor it. I have a driver who is Egyptian and is a lawyer, and he left Egypt. He's a Coptic Christian, and two of their churches were just bombed by ISIS yesterday, and it is a horrible tragedy in Egypt right now. In his church, he took his children to San Francisco just to show them that it's great to be a Coptic Christian, and they just killed like 40 people, injured 100 people in two churches on Palm Springs Sunday. And so my issue is, in some ways, I'm reminded of the Hegelian dialectic, how you slowly, by having a conflict, transform the culture, transform a society. What are your words of wisdom today about the real conflict with ISIS that's going on between You know, our Secretary of State is now in Moscow discussing the bombing in Syria and all of that. The big, big disagreement, if you can call it that way, is the ISIS crisis today. This is just discombobulating the whole world. What are some of your insights about that enormous political situation?
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah, well, just a couple of things about what's obviously a huge issue in our world and one that has dimensions that are beyond my comprehension or my knowledge base. The first thing I would say is that I think it's very, very important to reject alternative facts and stick with real facts when it comes to this debate over what our president wants to call radical Islamic terrorism. You know, if you look at the statistics, I'm actually more scared of white guys, heavily armed white guys with ball caps who live up in the hills of this country or in the backwoods, and many of whom are Christian, than I am of some folks who claim an affiliation with the Muslim tradition, for which I have enormous respect and in which many of my friends stand, who claim that affiliation but are in fact using it as political cover. So you can go to the Southern Poverty Law Center and you can get right on their website some very sound statistics about who is actually causing the violence in this country, which is not for a moment to minimize or overlook the violence abroad, which the caller mentioned and which is indeed horrific and grievous. But what is it that we ought to be scared of? I'm frankly more scared of people in the White House right now and their impact on my hometown of Madison, Wisconsin, than I am of some of the folks they want me to be scared of, which is why I've joined an organization here called Open Houses for Refugees and work of that sort, Open Doors for Refugees. The second thing I'd say is that with regard to violence generally, there's a single line that came to me at one point as I was writing, I guess, Healing the Heart of Democracy, that I keep thinking about, and I don't mean that it's you know, the formula that illumines everything. I just mean that I think it's worth meditating on. And that is that violence is what happens when we don't know what else to do with our suffering. Violence is what happens when we don't know what else to do with our suffering. You know, I think for millennia now, the wisdom, the great wisdom traditions and religious traditions have been trying to address this problem. How else can we hold our suffering than turning to violence? And there are many answers in the course of human history, and there are many things that we can do for ourselves and for each other that help alleviate suffering in a way, or support people in their suffering in a way that turns them from violence. I mean, let me be very personal about this. I told the story earlier of the man who rubbed my feet during my first profound clinical depression. Every other day during that depression, I was thinking about violence aimed at myself. It's called suicide. And as I wrote about in a book called Let Your Life Speak, people go around saying, I don't understand why so-and-so committed suicide. Well, I understand it perfectly. They did it because they needed the rest. Depression is an exhausting experience, and you can see no way out. It's not like being lost in the dark. It's like becoming the dark. And so your sense of self is annihilated. Why not finish the job? I understand that perfectly. what I don't understand, what we all ought to be baffled about, is how do some people find their way through in a way that allows them not only to survive, but eventually to thrive? If we knew the answer to that, we could actually do something useful to help more people not turn their suffering into violence directed at themselves or at others. So the first movement of the heart around violence ought to be empathy for those who turn to violence and the question, why? There are, of course, people who simply turn to violence, and I'm not trying to excuse them. I'm not trying to get them off the hook. What I'm asking for is, in a wide range of cases, that we ask the question behind the question, and that we work on a society which begins at home and it begins in our neighborhoods and in our local communities, where people have enough sense of having their suffering understood and cared about and acted upon in a positive manner, that they don't have to resort to violence because they don't know what else to do with their suffering.
That's beautiful, Parker. I'm so grateful for what you just said. You know, I remember when Robin Williams died, I heard that you said he needed a rest, and I thought that was a beautiful beautiful statement.
Mm.
I also heard that, you know, Leonard Cohen passed away right after the election. And an actress said he got out just in time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
a
beautiful way to think about what else to do about ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. Fortunately, before he checked out, Leonard said, "Democracy is coming to the USA," and it's still possible that it will.
So, is anybody on the phone? Because we're nearing the end of our hour here, Maggie.
We have one more caller.
How about if we just take the call without commenting on it, just to thank them for saying something? Okay.
Okay, sure. Hello, caller from Ohio.
Hi, my name is Barbara Dragel, and I'm a Jewish educator in Cincinnati. And my favorite education book is The Courage to Teach. And back to the focus of the conversation around how to facilitate and play a role in creating opportunities for intergenerational dialogue, as someone who works in a synagogue setting, it's absolutely one of our goals and purposes and where we find meaning as a community. And one of the things I've been reflecting on in this conversation is, Parker, I think in your book you refer to the sacred thing at the center that brings teachers and students together.
Mm-hmm.
And my question to you is, in thinking about where we are today and the opportunities for intergenerational dialogue and action, what do you see as the sacred things at the center that bring us together across those generations?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could respond, and then we'll come to a close, Parker.
Thank you, first of all, for your kind words about the book. And throughout the Jewish educational community in synagogues and in Hillel, at the Eye Center in Chicago, I've had some extraordinary experiences with this intergenerational conversation. I think what needs to be at the center of that conversation is that it doesn't matter how old we are, the search for meaning and purpose never ends. You know, I've got a 26-year-old granddaughter who is really struggling with her sense of vocation, and she came over to talk the other night, and I said, "Well, Heather, I've got good news and bad news for you, and it's both the same news. At age 78, I'm still having the same struggle. why am I here? What am I supposed to be doing?" And I hope that's reassuring for you, but I can understand how it might not be. But I think when we can talk put that at the center between the generations, we start getting somewhere. It's a way of saying we're both in need of light, and it's not something that I have that I will shed on your life. It's something that we can shed on each other's lives in equal measure.
All right, thank you, Parker. Any final things, Parker, you want to say, or if I just want to say I appreciate it that you're still in the world, and you have such a beautiful language and poetry in expressing things. I just it's just a joy to listen to you and read you and know you're still out there. So thank you for that. Anything you'd like to say finally, Parker or John?
Yeah, I want to thank Parker. I think the well from which he drinks is one that his being commends to me, and it is the way of being a friend, which I think is another way of talking about the Quaker way of understanding the world. And Parker, it comes from you like water falling on us. I mean, it's just so clear that there is a source, and I want to appreciate that source.
Well, thank you both so much. This really has been a conversation among friends, and I'm very grateful to have the opportunity. Happy to be here in this world with both of you good people. And Maggie, you're folded into that too. We haven't met, but I've really enjoyed working with you in preparing for this. So many thanks for the opportunity, and take good care.
Okay, Maggie, you want to close?
Sure. Well, I'm feeling overwhelmed and so appreciative. Thank you. Thank you, Parker, Peter, and John. This has been an amazing conversation. Thank you to our listeners and those who joined in the chat. I will get a transcript of that chat and provide it to Parker so he could see the community, and John and Peter, who they can see what was going on behind the scenes. We will have this recording posted on the website, www.abundantcommunity.com. And also, if you want to hear more about Parker's work, you can visit his website at www.couragerenewal.org. So thank you again for joining us today. And next time we'll be on Tuesday, June 6th. So look for us then. And until then, please visit our website and stay in touch with us. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Appreciate your time here today. And this brings our program to a close. And thanks for joining us.